Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you very warmly to the fourth lecture in the school's European series, which, as you know, is marking the UK's presidency of the European Union. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome tonight Lord Paton of Barnes, who we have every reason to expect will more than meet the exacting intellectual and rhetorical standards of this series. Now, it's customary to say that a famous speaker, needs no introduction. In Chris's case, however, that's not quite true, because it's quite easy to forget the long list of challenges which he has taken on in his career, all of which, in some sense, no doubt, have made the man. These include being the youngest ever director of the Conservative Research Department, where I was later to cut my own teeth, being Conservative member for Bath from 1979 to 1992, Minister for Overseas Development from 1986 to 89, Secretary of State for the Environment, Chairman of the Conservative Party, Governor of Hong Kong, and European Commissioner for External Relations, to name but a few. And perhaps most impressively, an easy and persuasive way with Margaret Thatcher, notwithstanding their differences. So, in short, a case of no job too large, as it were. I should add that he's also Chancellor of Oxford and Newcastle Universities. We all have our crosses to bear. But whether he's at LSE tonight because he thinks this is a worthwhile institution or because he does not fear the competition, I can't be sure, but I hope and expect that it is the former. Now, it's sometimes said that Chris is an intellectual who unusually chose politics, and to British eyes, of course, there can be few more dangerous beasts than that. I can say he is indeed an intellectual, but he is no ingenue in the political world, for he is political to his fingertips. And luckily for us, though, Chris is also a writer of insight and great elegance, with a novelist's eye for the telling detail and a rare ability to present the big picture without numbing the reader with trends and demographics and statistics. And above all, perhaps, he has a sense of history. His latest book, Not Quite the Diplomat, has all these ingredients in spades and is a cracking read. As hopefully you will have seen, it is on sale outside the lecture hall, and Chris will also be signing copies up here on the podium from about 10 to 8. So, as I say, I strongly commend that particular purchase to you. And as someone who has observed Europe from all around the globe and lived it from Whitehall and from Brussels, not to mention that seething cauldron which is the House of Commons, Chris is uniquely placed to educate us students of Europe. So Chris, the floor is yours.
Maurice, thank you very much indeed for that kind and mostly accurate obituary. I'm glad you said that I had been called upon to mark the otherwise not very deeply marked British presidency of the European Union. I'll do my best and hope that others do even better during the next couple of months. Can Europe be put back together again? The British Surgeon General, at the time of the Crimea War, heavily criticized because of the inadequacy of the medical services, noted that they would have been perfectly adequate had it not been for the casualties. I think there's a danger of the political class in Europe and in this country too behaving in much the same way, reacting with the same sort of sentiments to the electoral turbulence of the past year. We've had the French referendum, the no to the constitutional treaty, or perhaps more accurately, the no to President Chirac. one sympathizes. We've had the Dutch referendum with all that it told us about Dutch attitudes to multiculturalism. We had the German election result with the head under the sheets sentiments of the electorate. We've had elections elsewhere, for example, the regional elections in Italy, with the Italian electorate now turning, he said, not just loyally, with enthusiasm to the prospect of Italian financial stability being restored by the former president of the European Commission. And we have the UK election result, in which a prime minister who had plainly, for a variety of reasons, lost the benefit of the doubt as far as the electorate was concerned, was nevertheless re-elected with a substantial majority on less than 36% of the vote, which was more or less the figure that Neil Kinnock got in 1992 when he lost the election very heavily. How should we respond to these electoral turmoils? I've been at a number of conferences in recent weeks where a variety of responses have been suggested. Sometimes I've heard European politicians saying that what we need is a new media. Sometimes I've heard those listening to the same European politicians saying that we need new political leaders. And sometimes I've heard political leaders sound remarkably like Brecht in that poem of his, The Solution, in which he once suggested that the real answer for the East German government when things weren't going well was to dissolve the electorate and send for a new one. What is really going on in Europe? First of all, I believe that we're facing an institutional reality, not an institutional crisis. What's been achieved in the European Union in terms of sovereignty sharing is remarkable. We've created this extraordinary single market. We've created, which at least embraces 12 national economies, the Eurozone. We have an environment policy which covers the whole of the EU. And after enlargement, we can now say that almost every European country is either already a member of the European Union or wishes to be so, with one or two holdouts, Norway, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Iceland. But political and economic integration can't, in my judgment, go on forever. Why not? Why not? Because there's a real problem of accountability in Europe. The nation state remains the largest entity to which people feel naturally any affection or loyalty. The institutions of nation states are the institutions, again, to which people feel instinctively loyal. Citizens may recognize the importance of their nation state working with others in order to cope with international problems or deal with international opportunities. But they don't feel the same loyalty or affection towards the institutions set up to manage shared sovereignty as they do to their own national institutions. Their instincts are still very much pinned to the national organizations and bodies which they feel reflect their democratic aspirations. Say we have a European Parliament, a virtual parliament, because there is no European electorate. Money, goods, people move across frontiers. But political cultures, politics, find it much more difficult to do so. The democratic vigour, the democratic legitimacy, the democratic accountability in Europe is focused on nation states. So we're not constructing in Europe, nor were we ever doing so, a super state, the country, as some have witlessly spoken, the country called Europe. The fact that people do speak like that, do make that criticism, reflects to some extent the fact that Europhiles have often been victims of our own vanity. At the beginning of the convention, which produced the constitutional treaty of blessed memory, some of its authors spoke about the process in terms which suggested that they were involved in a rerun of the Philadelphia Convention, which produced the American Constitution over 200 years ago. But the two enterprises were fundamentally different. In Philadelphia, subnational entities had come together to try to create a nation state. In Europe, ancient nation states were coming together to agree the terms on which they were prepared to share sovereignty, a completely different process. I think that it's, and it's the first point I want to make in responding to this question, I think that European politicians have to accept that we've gone about as far in promoting political integration as the electoral market will bear. I don't think that there is an electorate anywhere in Europe which would vote for a European tax system, a European social security system, for handing over foreign policy to Brussels. That's just not going to happen. I think what Europe has to do is to focus on what it already has to manage and to do that job rather better in the future than it's done to date. A main reason why electorates have rejected governments, why radical reform has been more difficult, has been the inadequate economic performance of a number of European governments. For 30 years after the Second World War, we saw a closing of the gap between the standard of living in Europe and the standard of living in the United States. We moved from a position where Europe's figure was about 40% of the American to a position where it was about 70%. And Germany was the main economic engine of progress during that period. We grew out of the rubble of the Second World War. They were the Trente Glorieuses, as the French called them, a description based on the title of a book which described two villages which seemed completely different but turned out to be the same village at a 30-year interval of time. That was a period of extraordinary economic success. Mae West once said, I used to be Snow White, but I drifted. And that was Europe's Snow White period. The drift began with the two oil shocks of the 1970s. We experienced unemployment and inflation. Growth faltered. The public finances across Europe deteriorated. And the stuttering recovery that was made at the end of the 1980s was set back by one glorious event, the reunification of Germany. Glorious but costly. Berlin's transfers to the Eastern Länder since 1991 have totaled 1,250 billion euros. Through the 1990s, we saw painful efforts to align the costs of social policies that we'd come to take for granted with a pretty desultory economic performance. I think it's fair to say that preparations for the creation of the Eurozone applied discipline to member states to clear up their public finances. Governments kept inflation low, but in a number of countries, unemployment became worryingly high, with social costs and rigid labour markets inhibiting job creation. For some time, outsiders, I think, used to exaggerate European economic vitality. It's not very long ago that Lester Thurow wrote a couple of books suggesting that Europe was about to knock the socks off the Americans. I think to some extent our problems are exaggerated in the contrary direction today, and some people exaggerate how much better they think America is doing than Europe. It's true that America's economy is growing more rapidly than Europe's. That's largely a result of the fact that the American population is still growing by about 1% a year, though that is almost entirely a result of immigration from the Hispanic South and from Asia. The figures for productivity growth and productivity per head tell a much more confusing story, partly because of differences in statistical method. In the last few years, GDP per head has probably been rising slightly faster in Europe. If you measure GDP by hours worked, then the figures seem to be pretty well level pegging. A lot of America's advantage when it occurs is a consequence of American size, a consequence of the increased productivity in retail and distribution that results from being able, for example, to develop shed-like retail developments, Walmart, Home Depot, and so on their greenfield sites. Two other questions which it's worth raising, in my view, about America's alleged greater economic vitality. The first is whether it's really sensible for us now to regard a savings rate of less than 2% of household income, the situation in the United States, as a sign of greater economic virtue than a figure which is six times that large in Europe. Secondly, and it shows how old-fashioned I am, I grew up in a world in which having a large trade surplus wasn't regarded as a mortal sin. I now look at the comparison between the German and indeed the Eurozone's normal trade surplus with what is happening in the United States, and find it difficult to regard what is happening in America as, again, a sign of virtue. America has to borrow about $2.3 billion a day, weekends included, in order to pay for its trade deficit. It's hoovering up, or I suppose one should now say dicening up, Chinese savings, the savings of Chinese peasants, in order to finance its deficit. The United States is borrowing as much as it can in order to pay for whatever the rest of the world is manufacturing. Is that sustainable? Will there come a moment when people wake up and smell the coffee? I just remember the first law of economics as enunciated by Herb Stein: things that can't go on forever don't. Nevertheless, it is true that Europe hasn't continued to close the gap in the difference of living standards with the United States, and that is plainly because Europe tends to take its productivity gains in more leisure and shorter working hours, America in higher pay. I think that we're more inclined in Europe to take holidays than risks. It's also clearly the case that flexible labour markets in America have meant that the impact of new technology has been to raise inequality, even while employment levels have remained high, whereas the opposite has happened in Europe, so that we have levels of unemployment which would be politically unacceptable in the United States, and the Americans have levels of social inequity which would be politically intolerable in Europe. Clearly, there are a number of things which we have to do at a European level and at national level in order to deal with our slow growth. And I just want to mention one at European level, encouraged to do so by a photograph of Europe's Trade Commissioner in the Green Room. We do have to open up our markets to cheaper products and more efficient producers. And it's against that background that I regarded the row about textiles, the great bra war, not in my name, as someone said, that I regarded that as a lamentable development in European economic policy, as well as I'll suggest later in our relations with China. The multifiber agreement was a pretty deplorable example of rich country protectionism for a number of years. We spent 10 years allegedly dismantling it, with consequences which were predicted and predictable. I used to preside with Pascal Lamy from time to time over conferences in Brussels at which we discussed what would happen when the multifiber agreement came to an end. Well, what happened, of course, was that there was a surge in exports from China. And the two countries which import the largest number of textiles from China, the French and the Italians, led the opposition to what was happening and the demands for us to inhibit, to curb the growth in Chinese exports. 23 out of 25 European Union member states, to their shame, agreed to a deal which Mr. Mandelson concluded, I think against his better judgment, last summer, and which has now unravelled and had to be replaced by a rather more sensible set of arrangements. It is, I think, what has happened, a sign of growing protectionism in Europe, with probably worse manifestations of the same in the United States. And it presents a pretty gloomy backdrop to the Doha development round and to the ministerial meeting that's taking place in Hong Kong in December. I wish there were more pressure from business for a successful conclusion to that round. If there's no deal in December, then two developments are entirely predictable. First, that there will be more bilateral deals, particularly between bigger and richer countries and poorer ones. And I know of no such deal which acts in the interests of poorer countries. If you look at a paradigm of those sort of agreements, for example, the US-Jordan agreement of 3 or 4 years back, plainly, when you look at the intellectual property provisions of the agreement, they're pretty tough on the Jordanians. Secondly, if we don't get an agreement at Hong Kong in December, then it's likely that the president will lose in the United States, will lose his fast-track authority from Congress, that there'll be no chance of concluding any multilateral agreement for some years after that. So I do worry that what has happened over the last months, this increasing protectionism in Europe and America, will get worse over the next few years and will make it more difficult for us to increase the rate of growth in our economy. I don't feel catatonically gloomy about what's happening on the economic scene in Europe. First of all, I'm encouraged by what is happening in some of the newer member states, which appear to have signed up to a low-tax, deregulatory agenda. Secondly, I'm not sure what the alternative to a liberalizing agenda actually is in France or Italy or Germany. I've just been reading a bit of Chinese history in order to prepare an article on the Three Emperors exhibition, which is taking place at the Royal Academy in a few weeks' time. And I came upon once again that extraordinary book by Alain Perrefit on the McCartney expedition, diplomatic mission to China in 1783, when he tried to convince China that it should develop a trading relationship with the rest of the world. And when I read Chin Long's response to Lord McCartney, his polite but firm letter saying that there was nothing China needed from the rest of the world, that it was very kind of the rest of the world to offer to sell its manufactures, very kind and gracious of the rest of the world to incline itself to civilization, as Emperor Qianlong put it. But China was perfectly all right on its own. And I hope you won't think it's too ad hominem, I drew immediately parallels between the Emperor Qianlong and what one hears from time to time from the Elysee Palace and even from the Matignon. That sense of exceptionalism, that globalization can be held at bay, I think is rather similar to the attitude espoused by the later Qing emperors. I think reform has to be driven by another factor as well. And let me put it very briefly. In every country, whether Catholic or not, from Brazil to China, where there is, first of all, relatively easy access to cheap and reliable contraceptives, where there is female education, and where there is even a modicum of economic growth, there is in all those countries a fall in the birth rate. The fertility rate has fallen well below replacement levels in every European country except Albania, and is still falling. The countries with the lowest birth rates are those with the most traditional views of the role of women. So we've moved from baby boom to baby bust without any intervening period. It's interesting, particularly about Europe, that after the reign of a pope who had such a substantial impact on the political geography of the continent, there was clearly so little impact on family attitudes, especially in countries like Poland and Italy and Spain, where there are at least the largest number of signed-up Catholics. At the same time that we're seeing a fall in the birth rate, we're also seeing people living longer, and therefore a huge increase in age dependency. Fewer people we know at work, as Adair Turner is about to instruct us, looking after more people out of work, either children or retired. And that is going to have colossal consequences for our social and economic policies. But more than that, it makes it very difficult, in my judgment, to consider Europe as a potential superpower, given that its population is going to be falling, that it will be having a smaller share of global trade and output, and that it has at the moment a falling underlying growth rate. It's going to, in particular, to have to look at competition from Asia and the new giants in India and China. When some politicians talk about Polish plumbers, those ubiquitous plumbers who apparently threaten our living standards, I think they should be much more concerned about Indian and Chinese software programmers and engineers. What we're seeing in India and China is the turn of the wheel. For 18 out of the last 20 centuries, China has been the largest economy in the world. Angus Maddison, the best of economic historians, points out that from 1500 to about 1820, India and China represented over 50% of global GDP. That fell, partly because of the Industrial Revolution, partly because of the consequences of the Raj, partly because of the consequences of internal division and Maoism in China, that fell to about 8% by 1950. And what we've seen in the last 50 years, which shouldn't perhaps entirely surprise us, is a recovery in India and China. As in China, the country has pursued more sensible economic policies, and as in India, the Indian government has started to rewrite the socialism which was written into the preamble to the Indian constitution. By the end of the 20th century, India and China represented 18%, perhaps a little more, of world GDP, and I guess that by perhaps 2020, that could be up to 30% or thereabouts. I'm happy to talk a bit more about India and China in questions, but it seems to me that the important thing for Europe to do in relation to both those great economies is to persuade our American colleagues that the transatlantic community, that America and Europe, can no longer set the international agenda without involving other great players. We have to involve India and China in global governance, and we have to persuade China and India to join us in a rules-based system of economic governance, as well as in political cooperation to deal with problems from in the environment to proliferation of nuclear weapons. It's in that spirit that plainly the protectionism shown in recent months sends so many bad messages. It's impossible for us to carry much conviction if we say to the Chinese that we want them to play by the rules, and then when the rules don't suit us, try to change them. The most successful foreign policy that Europe has pursued is, as I said earlier, the policy of enlargement. Enlargement which brought in, for example, Spain and Portugal and Greece after they shook off authoritarian fascist regimes. Enlargement which, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, offered the countries of Central and Eastern Europe membership of the European Union and helped in that way to stabilize what could otherwise have been an extremely disruptive period in European history following the collapse of Russia's European empire. It's obviously the case that we can't go on offering enlargement as our foreign policy tool forever. Somewhere between the Polish-Ukraine border and North Korea, the process of enlargement plainly has to end. But I don't think it should end just yet. I think it's important that we should keep to our promises in relation to to Croatia and the Western Balkans, provided they remain committed to political and economic reform. It is my personal view that we should offer membership of the European Union to Ukraine and Moldova. I think it is very difficult for us to argue after the events in Ukraine of a few months ago that we recognize Ukraine's vocation in Europe, but can't accept Ukraine as a potential member of the European Union. And in particular, I believe extremely strongly that we have to keep our word to Turkey, provided that Turkey continues itself on the road of economic and political reform. I think that the Turks still have a great deal to do to convince us that democracy is firmly rooted in their country and the rule of law and the protection of civil liberties. I think there is an agenda which hasn't been completed in relation to the Kurds and in relation to Armenia. I think that the Turkish political class has to accept that in plural open societies, history is something that we're entitled to argue about. But all that said, it seems to me clearly the case that Turkey's membership of the European Union would make the European Union more effectively flexible, would help to dynamize the European economy at a time when it's starting to look at least potentially rather sclerotic, would help to build bridges of tolerance not only to Islamic communities within Europe but to Islamic communities outside Europe, and would have substantial geopolitical advantages in the Middle East and indeed in West Asia beyond. I think it's extremely difficult for European politicians to talk about being taken seriously as a world player if at the same time we turn our back on Turkish membership of the European Union. Let me, before opening the evening to questions, let me just make one final point. About 3 years ago, I was flying back from Tokyo from meetings with Mr. Koizumi, and at 40,000 feet or so above the frozen Russian tundra, with the air stewardess laying my breakfast tray, found myself nervously responding to her when she said, "Mr. Patton, can I ask you a rather personal question?" Having given my reply that indeed she could, she said to me charmingly, "Do you think, Mr. Patton," she said, "that we'll ever actually join Europe?" I thought of all those treaties and European councils and visionary speeches by prime ministers and foreign ministers. Would we ever actually join Europe? It is the great existential question in British politics. It's a question which has destroyed careers. Not necessarily a reference to yesterday. It's a question which has divided parties. It's a question which has demeaned our media. It's a question which has very often inhibited our governments from pursuing as vigorously as they should the national interest. It's partly a consequence of our failure, even 43 years after he made that speech, our failure to answer Dean Acheson's question that we'd lost an empire but failed to find a role. Partly a consequence of our struggle with our own national identity, partly a consequence of the extent to which we see ourselves and our history almost entirely through the country's finest hour in the Second World War, and it was fine. I am interested by the extent to which the debate about Europe, for example, is conducted through selective quotations from the speeches and writings of a politician, a great one, Winston Churchill, who was born in 1874. It's partly also the fact that we know from Flanders and Swan, the English are best, I wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest. All those factors which play into our huge difficulty in actually working out what role we should play in Europe and what role on the international stage. But while we've got an existential question, so have the French and so have the Germans. For years, the French were able to avoid making a choice between Monet and de Gaulle by the fact that they thought that it didn't really matter, that they didn't really have to make that choice, because whatever happened, they ran the show anyway. But plainly, that is no longer the case. And what of Germany? I remember Chancellor Kohl saying to me at one meeting that whenever anybody talked to him about national sovereignty, he wanted to bury German sovereignty in a wider European project. And his generation of German politicians did believe that in order to demonstrate to the rest of us that Germany was no longer moved by the attractions of leather and steel, that Germany had to put its own destiny at the service of Europe, had to pay for whatever Europe wanted to do, had at the when push came to shove, had to accept whatever the French agenda might be. That's no longer true. Germany is an established and successful democracy. German politicians no longer feel they have anything to prove, and they certainly don't feel that they have any obligation to continue paying for the rest of the European project. So the three main powers in Europe, the two permanent members of the Security Council, the two members of the European Union with nuclear deterrents, deterring quite whom, I'm not sure, the two countries with nuclear weapons, I don't say independent nuclear weapons, but the two countries with nuclear weapons, the countries with a commercial and diplomatic reach that goes right round the globe, all have their problems working out what sort of Europe they want to be part of. And I mean no disrespect to Italians or Spaniards or Portuguese or Greeks or Poles or Lithuanians or Estonians or the rest when I say that Europe only really works when France and Germany and Britain are capable of working together. We need to work together in order for Europe to be a bit more effective, in order for Europe to demonstrate that it can be a good, responsible, and competent partner of the United States. Not a rival to the United States, that is simply vainglorious, but a serious partner. Because unless we can demonstrate that we can be serious partners, I think it may be more difficult for us to persuade America to return to that traditional approach to global leadership, which has itself been challenged by this Republican administration, by the neoconservatives, the assertive nationalists, and by many in the think tanks and in the media. For years after the war, the Second World War, Americans led the way in putting in place institutions of global cooperation. Institutions and an approach to global leadership which legitimized American power, which protected America from the world's envy, and which provided the infrastructure within which we could deal with global problems. I think that it is a tragic paradox that at precisely the moment that we need that sort of approach and that sort of cooperation more than ever, it should be spurned by this administration. And I think that one way in which we can perhaps persuade the Americans to return to a more sensible way of doing things is by Europe getting its act together itself. Thank you very much.
Chris, thank you very, very much. You have given us a fantastic amount of food for thought in your your customary elegant delivery, lapidary, short, succinct statements and propositions, which I hope we'll be able to repeat in questions. We've got about half an hour or so for questions. I incline towards taking them individually rather than clustered. Chris, is that all right with you? Yeah? If you could identify yourself in the traditional way and give your affiliation. Please keep the question short and crisp, as I say, and please don't try to smuggle in a second question, and just keep it very simple. Okay, so who would like to kick off? The gentleman at the front here has caught my eye.
Thank you. It was a really interesting talk, and my question would be: I took note of the fact that when you mentioned these emerging giants, India and China, and I completely agree, they should really be the concern, not the Polish plumbers. You mentioned Europe as an actor. I mean, Europe or the US should realize this and take note of this. But my question would be, to what degree, without the kind of changes and reforms in the European institutions that the Constitutional Treaty was supposed to bring, to what degree can Europe really work, especially if you enlarge it to Turkey and all the rest of those countries, which I'm also very much in favor, but I don't see it working. And I would say that probably the European electorate, with the spectacle of European impotence before these big giants, would change its mind. Thank you.
In my experience, it was always true that the Chinese, for instance, believed more passionately in the European project than most Europeans. The notion of Europe, I mean the completely crazed right-wing conservative notion of Europe as a super state, actually came quite close to what the Chinese thought and even hoped was happening, because met their world view. I used to have to explain to them that, for example, in foreign policy, since no issue goes to the heart of national sovereignty more clearly, it was always going to be difficult for Europe to have a single foreign policy, and that for us to have from time to time a common foreign policy enunciated in their different ways by 25 Periclean foreign ministers and Javier Solana was about as far as we should go. Now, I don't actually think that the loss of the Constitutional Treaty, sad as it was, because in my judgment it did define the distinctions, it did define the difference between what should be done at the pan-European level and what should be done at the national level more clearly, more succinctly, better than any previous document. I think it's sad that that has been lost. But I don't think the loss of the constitutional treaty itself weakens Europe in relation to China and India. There are two things which would weaken, or three things which would weaken Europe in relation to those emerging countries, and I'll touch on them very briefly. The first is if we do nothing or next to nothing to try to prevent our underlying growth rate continuing to slide. That would mean that we were a less attractive economic partner, a less well-endowed investor, a less admirable potentially dangerous competitor. Secondly, I was at Stanford University recently talking to the president, among other things, making a speech on foreign policy, but talking to President Hennessy as well. And President Hennessy said that he'd recently been at a meeting of university rectors in Europe, at which he'd listened politely while people had spoken of their hope that they could persuade European governments to invest more in science and research and higher education, and therefore close the gap a little with the United States. And Hennessy said to me, I have to say that that's not the sort of competition we're nervous about in America. We're not looking at what's happening in Europe. We're looking at what's happening in China and in India. So I feel very strongly that unless European governments take a rather greater interest in the extremely enfeebled position of higher education right across the continent, and encourage greater public sector and private sector investment in science and research and development, we're going to find that we count for rather less in our dealings with China and India. We kid ourselves if we think that it's only in low value-added, low technology areas of economic development that we face competition. Simply not true. If you look, for example, at what the Chinese are doing in nanotechnology at the moment, it's increasingly state of the art. Thirdly, I think we have to show greater coherence and consistency in both our economic and political policies in relation to China and India. The way that the arms embargo has been handled with China has been a pretty disastrous example of how not to conduct foreign policy anywhere, but particularly in relation to China. So I think greater consistency is something else that we have to pursue. So economic reform to strengthen our economies, greater investment in science and research, and greater consistency in the way that we behave with those two giants.
Thank you. Might take a question from upstairs this time. Please do identify yourselves and say where you're from or what you're studying. So it fills in a bit of local colour. Are there any questions from up top? There's a gentleman right at the back there, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mic. He's now holding the mic. Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, you've done
the same. Sorry. Sorry to swerve a little bit from the grand ligne you're sort of drawing out here. And coming back to the constitutional kind of debate, as the sort of previous incumbent, would you say it's anywhere relevant that this whole debate about getting rid of the double-hatted and the external commissioner and the high representative, I mean, this is at the moment at least quite dead. Is that in any ways important?
The bipartisic point, you mean? I think that's the polite word for double-hatting. Not yet familiar Brussels speak, but it will be. Well, I think that the a double-hatted high representative made a great deal of sense, bringing together the political authority which Javier Solana has as the representative of the council, and the resources which are available to the commission, whether development assistance or political cooperation or whatever, bringing those things together in one structure under one person, I think makes a great deal of sense. I think there were some problems associated with it which had to be resolved. The first is that the High Representative would still be working as a representative of the Council. He wouldn't be in charge of the Council, even if he was chairing it. And there was, I think, I was never sure myself that it made sense for the High Representative both to be responsible for putting policy proposals to the Council and to be responsible for chairing the Council. It didn't quite answer the Henry Kissinger question, if I want to know what Europe's policy is, what number do I call? I just say in passing that I used to very often feel when I was a European commissioner that the same question operated in reverse. If one wanted to find out what American policy was, did you phone up the National Security Council, or did you phone up the Department of Defense, or did you phone up the State Department, or who? So it's a question which operates in both directions. But I think even with a bipotassic, even with a double-hatted high representative, any American Secretary of State would still find her or himself talking to the foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany, Spain. It would depend on what the issue was. I think it will be very difficult to put in place a double-hatted high representative and to carry through the institutional changes, weaving together the Council Secretariat and the Commission services without the endorsement of the Constitutional Treaty. I think that much can be done without the Constitutional Treaty, for example, in the areas of increasing parliamentary control, national parliamentary control over the legislative process. I don't think that needs constitutional change, and I don't think it needs constitutional change for the Council of Ministers to legislate openly, not behind closed doors. I think that the question of foreign policy is more difficult, and it wouldn't just be in this country that people would object without treaty change to any substantial or radical development.
Professor Roger Morgan?
Roger Morgan, I'm attached to the European University Institute in Florence. The Speaker began by suggesting that the British presidency of the EU had a rather low-key quality to it. If he were in charge of running the British presidency, what would he try to achieve?
Sorry to interrupt, just very briefly. So I will sometimes just repeat the question. We have a problem. We have a live video feed into, and the sound is at times a little bit inaudible. So it's not that you're deaf, Chris, but just to repeat Professor Roger Morgan's question, what can actually now be done with the British presidency? What Lord Patton would do?
Chance would be a fine thing. Let me say one thing complimentary, make one point which I think is of more general application to the way this government makes and pursues policy, and then say one thing in particular, two things which I would try to do. First of all, I give the government very high marks for the way it's pursued the question of Turkish accession to the European Union. I think it would have been a tragedy if the date for beginning the talks on Turkish accession had been allowed to slip, and I think that Jack Straw and the Foreign Office have done admirably well. Secondly, and I hope that if he's here he won't take it personally, but I think that there is something oxymoronic about the Prime Minister's approach to government and to policy, both abroad and at home. I think he is deeply superficial. And I think he tends to take the view that if he's made a speech, he's dealt with the problem. And it's why we have so many initiatives, why 1 week yobs are being required to respect the rest of us. The next week, terrorists are being banged up. The week after that, the education system is being reformed for the 47th time, and so on and so on. The Prime Minister made a really classy speech in the European Parliament, which doesn't hear too many of them, in July, and I think then thought he'd done his job. Go home, or go and stay with Cliff Richard, and that was Europe fixed for the next 6 months. And as the rest of us know, it's not quite that easy. Three things which I think the government should have the guts to try to do. First of all, I don't believe that we should put off the question of trying to resolve the rows over the budget until the Austrian presidency. I think we should actually face up to that ourselves. I think we should recognize that the present budgetary arrangements are indefensible, but they're indefensible because of the way the budget is spent. So we need a different correction mechanism from which we would probably get less, but then so would the French and so would the Italians and so would one or two others. It was politically impossible for Neil Kinnock and I as commissioners to sign up for a set of proposals for resolving the budget problem, which finished up with the French and the Italians getting three times as much or more out of the budget as the United Kingdom. I think that would involve continuing to press the case for cap reform, which is particularly important in relation to the Doha round, which I mentioned earlier. I think it was lamentable that the British government was one of 23 out of 25 which signed on for the deal which Peter Mandelson was pushed into agreeing on curbing Chinese textiles. I hope that was a blip in the otherwise admirable commitment of the British government to free trade and to oppose protectionism, but I would like to see some more evidence of that in the coming weeks. And one small thing, small but important and relevant to what I said earlier about science and research and development. The easy bit of the Lisbon Agenda, the really straightforward bit of the Lisbon Agenda, is the commitment on R&D. And part of that commitment was, as you'll recall, the suggestion that we should establish in the European Union a European equivalent of America's National Science Foundation to fund first-class research, basic research, frontier research, that it should be a foundation driven by scientists, not by bureaucrats, and that it should have a reasonable budget. And by reasonable, I mean within 2 or 3 years, up to 800 million or a billion. Again, I repeat, not for simply replicating what is already done under the framework programs, but for actually putting more money into basic research in classy institutions across Europe. It should be possible for the British government to get agreement to establish the European Research Council. We've already proposed the members of the Governing Council of the ERC. I chaired the committee which did that, and I think that would be at least a good sign of our commitment to do more on the Lisbon Agenda and to do more on research and development. I noticed the other day that Mr. Sarkozy made a speech during the course of which he argued passionately for more expenditure on research in Europe. It would have been more convincing if he hadn't been the finance minister who cut the research budget in France. So there's a lot for all of us to do if we're to be taken seriously on subjects like that.
So I might head upstairs again for a question. There is the lady at the back in a bright pink T-shirt.
Linda Corsher, I'm in the geography department here. You seem very definite that the French vote against the constitution was against Chirac and that the Dutch vote was against multiculturalism, but I suggest that perhaps people are recognising that the European project and the EU itself is actually being used as a mechanism for the to facilitate the interests of transnational finance, both externally and within the EU, not particularly European finance, and at the same time that there is an extreme lack of democracy, as you've pointed to yourself in regard to the European Parliament. An example of that is that at the very weekend that the two referenda took place, the EU tabled its offer on services at the WTO without there having been any debate in any member state or in any member state parliament, which is a huge thing. And similarly, the European internal directive on services was only just resisted. That was also being forced on people in the interest of transnational capital again and undemocratically.
Well, I think you and I probably take a slightly different view about how to generate prosperity and how even to distribute prosperity, but I'll put that on one side. I don't doubt that there were in France, and less so in the Netherlands, people who voted against the constitutional treaty because they thought it was a battering ram for global multinational capitalism. It was fairly rum that at the time that the constitutional treaty was being criticized in this country as an example of a socialist battering ram, it was being criticized on parts of the French left for the very opposite, but autre temps, autre mœurs, autre pays, autre mœurs. There would, of course, have been people in France who voted against the Constitution because they agree with Monsieur Beauvais. It's a great, long-standing, honourable French tradition of exceptionalism, which has fortunately been ignored by most French corporate life, which is busy buying up public utilities in every other country around the world, but denying us the opportunity of doing the same in France. It's a sort of it's a sort of globalism, which runs extremely effective motor car companies, aeroplane companies, which sells insurance very effectively around the world. So there is a gulf between the sort of reflection of Beauvais in parts of the French political establishment and how the French splendidly and competitively run their economy when they do so privately. I doubt whether there was much of that sentiment in the Netherlands, though there must be some of that sentiment on the left. I think more than that, in both countries, there was a sense, though I don't think it was the principal reason for the vote against the Constitution, there was a sense that enlargement meant that people's jobs were being threatened by Central and Eastern Europeans. I think if, insofar as that was something that people felt, it was both absurd and pretty unpleasant. And I think, too, that there was probably a bit of a sense that since this was coming from Brussels, it was another example of Brussels bullying nation states and simply going its own way without adequate accountability. There's an element of that in it. So it wasn't just, I concede, antipathy to President Chirac, or antipathy to multiculturalism, Netherlands style. I just make one other point. I think myself, Europe has demonstrated the value of knocking down frontiers rather than their importance in securing people's prosperity, standard of living, and quality of life. And to propose that the only way we can maintain our quality and standard of living is by raising barriers as far as the rest of the world is concerned, is a proposition against which I would react with some intellectual violence.
Hi, my name is Claudia Brinkman from the King's College London European Society. You emphasize the role of Great Britain, Germany, and France in Europe. How do you see then the role of Chirac, Blair, and Merkel in the progress of the European Union?
Oh, with some
in
depression.
any future treaties or how reform of the institutions? How will they work together?
Not very well. I mean, I think it is a sadness. I mean, you would probably expect me to say this anyway. I think it is a sadness that at the moment when it seems to me that there is more support for what you could by and large call an Anglo-Saxon agenda in Europe, though let me halt at that moment and just make one point. When I was a young man, when I was in the 1960s and 1970s writing pamphlets rather than books, I used to write pamphlets about the German economic model and about how we should embrace it in the United Kingdom when we were still in a state of sort of Paleolithic socialism. I used to write books about Ludwig Erhard and the importance of the social market economy. Now I find, to my surprise, that this is described as the Anglo-Saxon model. What has happened? So I think it's sad that at the moment when there is more support in Europe for the things that Britain has traditionally been arguing for within the European family, that some of Mr. Blair's credibility has drained away because of European public opinion's attitude to his relationship with President Bush and his behaviour over Iraq, and I think that's sad. The jury's still out on Angela Merkel. I wish her every success. I think she was jolly brave fighting an election campaign on the basis of tax increases. It hasn't always been successful in my experience, but maybe that was going to be different and she was just unlucky. I don't think Angela Merkel is another Margaret Thatcher. I think she's Angela Merkel, and it's rather unfair to both of them to suggest otherwise. I hope she does well. And certainly the rest of Europe wants her to do well. And insofar as she isn't able to push economic reforms, we know what will happen. The German industry will lay off German workers and open factories in Slovakia. The day after the German election results, Siemens sacked 2,300 workers in Germany. Chirac is still there. Until 2007, but I think we can say with some confidence that he is on the last course.
We can squeeze in probably one more question. We passed two more.
Yeah.
Okay. Lord Patton is enjoying himself. Well, we are all the beneficiaries. Two questions. Had you fingered somebody in particular, Chris? I saw you extending your hands as somebody you'd taken pity on.
Lady next to Professor Morgan. Oh.
Ah. Well, let there's...
Well, perhaps. Thank you for your choice. Anne Corbett, Disciplinary Institute of Management. I have a question I'd like to...
Anne, can you hold it very close to your mouth? Okay. It really makes a difference.
You said that the EU should focus on what it has to manage and do that job better. You've seen the management from the inside. What is the thing that you would most like to change there?
Let me first of all say another word about the general proposition. I think the easiest thing for European politicians to do is to give you their European vision. You know, most politicians can do visions at the drop of a hat. Vision is, on the whole, the easy bit. Running things competently is the difficult bit. And we all know that in politics, as in life, getting from A to B is much more difficult than getting from A to Z. So I think overall that the Commission has a great deal of power, though there are too many commissioners to exercise it competently. If you have 25 commissioners, you have to give 25 of them a job, and they're probably jobs, serious jobs, for 12 or 15. And you should, I'm not saying the others are idle, I'm sure they work incredibly hard and produce lots of paper. The important thing, the really important thing, is to deliver on the competences which have been given to the Commission as effectively as possible, whether trade or the single market or competition policy or agriculture or whatever. And I think it's very important that the Commission should be bold and bloody and resolute in doing that. I think it was a tragedy that the Commission was pushed off the Services Directive because Chancellor Schroeder and President Chirac barked. I think the Commission should have stood its ground and made a fuss and had a bloody fight about it. Far more sensible to have a fight about that than some of the other things that we have struggles about. In my experience, the Commission had as many, as high a proportion of competent civil servants as any other body that I've ever worked in. There were some people who were very good, there were some people who were not very good. Maybe it was more difficult to get rid of the ones that were not very good than it would have been in our national civil service, but it wasn't very easy there either. It's not very large, given the responsibilities which it discharges. Parche, the opinion of every London taxi driver, it's not run by the mafia. At the very worst, mismanagement of EU funds, mostly done by the governments that spend them, totals about 700 million euros a year. Look at the Department of Work and Pensions, which, according to the latest report, loses 3 billion a year in fraud. I just wish I met a few more taxi drivers who'd known that, not least met them at dinner parties, where they tend to be fairly prominent too. But I do think that the problem that those, you know, reasonably able people have is working in a culture in which risk is frowned on. It's very difficult in that culture to cut corners. It's very difficult to be creative in the bureaucracy. There are all too many reasons why people should want to go home at the end of the day grateful that they haven't had to make a decision rather than they've made a decision and are making something happen. And that's largely a consequence of some of the political criticism which the Commission has had over the years. So I would most want to try to change the administrative culture with which the Commission, or in which the Commission operates.
Okay, if we do two very, very quick ones. There's a gentleman at the front there, and the lady over there, and this will be the last. Please keep your questions short and say who you are. Thank you.
Lord Patton, last night on this...
Sorry, who are you? Just wonder if you could say who you are.
My name is Barry Feinberg. I'm an architect. Last night on this same platform, Professor Paul Rogers, concluding a debate on very similar issues about world affairs, put it to the audience and the panel that whilst the threat to world peace during the Cold War was very critical, and that the years since the fall of the Berlin Wall have been very much more benign, that nevertheless the threat of global warming was of even greater dimensions and was impending and required some response. It was tacked on to the end of the largely political debate. What I want to ask you, or to remind you, is that I heard you speak in the Reith lectures a year or two ago and give a very ecologically framed view of world issues and of the need for politics somehow to be re-aggregated in some form that could confront that ecological threat. I saw or thought I heard no echo of those sentiments in what I've heard from you tonight, only a continued stress on economic development and competitiveness, when the papers, including today's Independent, are full of information about the unsustainability of the Chinese growth, coupled with Indian growth and growth generally, and the inability of the world resources to continue to supply that particular need. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I can do one of my other speeches if you'd like. let me comment very briefly. I mean, I think I referred to the environment as one of the reasons why we needed international cooperation at an even more profound level today than we'd enjoyed in the past. But let me just say something specifically about the environment and attitudes to the environment. In 1989-90, I was Secretary of State for the Environment. And in that job, I had to preside over the London conference, which was called to tighten up the Montreal Protocol on ozone-depleting substances, on halons and chlorofluorocarbons. We were pressed to stop production and use of CFCs on the basis of the precautionary principle, which Europeans at the time were pretty chary about accepting, but which an American administration insisted that we should take seriously. It was an American administration which also argued passionately that we should recognize common but differentiated responsibilities. In other words, in relation to CFCs and halons, that we should recognize that the Indians and Chinese did not bear the same share of responsibility for what had happened to the ozone layer as we did in the Western world, but that we needed to draw them into the process in order to stand any chance of actually coping with the environmental problem. So as part of the agreement that we reached in London on the Montreal Protocol, we agreed on a phasing in of Indian and Chinese compliance, a substantial amount of technology transfer to India and China, and a lot of resourcing of the Indians and Chinese so they could have refrigerators, as it were, without increasing the risks of cancer on Bondi Beach. So that was the Americans in 1989 and 90. What is the attitude of the United States and Australia, to its shame, today? The attitude is, first of all, that it's impossible to get international agreement on targets and curbs, and secondly, because India and China aren't involved in the first stage of the Kyoto Protocol, that these big rich countries can't sign it, and are even negotiating with the Indians and Chinese about some rather vacuous agreement for the future in which we'll invest in hydrogen and hope that things turn out for the best in the best of all possible worlds. For me, it's an extraordinary shift in attitudes, and an extraordinary shift in attitudes in particular to global leadership. I agree with whoever was saying last night that the threat of climate change is a huge problem for us internationally, not least because of its insidiousness. I believe that it's the most important issue which we should be facing in our diplomacy and in our economic assistance programs to others, and that unless we manage to involve Indians and Chinese in a way which they regard as fair, then we're simply not going to be able to tackle the problem. I've never believed that economic development could be recklessly pursued regardless of its sustainability. And having for 5 years of my life flown in and out regularly of Hong Kong and seen the horizon to the north looking as though on a fine day it had been simply painted with a great yellow brush, having seen some of the pollution coming down the Pearl River, or the once Pearl River, I have no doubt at all about the importance of helping India and China tackle their environmental problems, and I'm heartened by the fact that at least intellectually President Hu Jintao recognized that himself. But we're in a ludicrous position in which the world's only superpower is telling two of the future, if not superpowers, great powers, that international agreements and curbs don't matter. Plainly, they matter enormously. If you're buying property with an eye to the next 30 or 40 years, I'd go uphill in London if I were you.
But Lord Patton, I think we will sadly have to draw things to a close here. I apologise to the lady I'm going to have to let down. I'm not naturally a slippery and untrustworthy person, but I'm afraid time is pressing on. And Lord Patton would like to be able to sign copies of his book. Just before we record our thanks and appreciation to Lord Patton, just to remind you of the next two lectures in the European series. Next week on the 27th we have the Governor of the Turkish Central Bank talking about the Turkish economy and the EU, and on the 1st of November we have the eminent historian Professor Norman Stone, who's going to be trying to answer the question, where does Europe end? Now Chris, thank you very much indeed. You have given us a
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to be at the next two lectures. If I can just make two predictions. First of all, the governor of the Turkish Central Bank will think that the Turkish economy is going very well. And Professor Norman Stone, who now works at a university in Turkey, will think that that the boundaries of Europe end the other side of Anatolia. But that's just...
Thank you, Chris.